Now, apparently this past week for some Australian retailers has been the busiest in their history. The Financial Review yesterday had the Q clothing company saying they'd sold more than during any Boxing Day sale, but only after they slashed prices following poor sales in March, April and May. Well, there doesn't seem to be anything like that happening in many parts of the Northern Hemisphere. The noted US economist Paul Krugman, writing in the New York Times this week, in fact warned that the world was entering a third depression, the first being at the end of the 19th century, then the Great Depression of the 30s, and now he believes we're entering a third, though not as acute as the 30s. Krugman argues that this depression is being driven by a failure of policy, as the world responds in a more or less fundamentalist way to the debt crisis in Europe and elsewhere. Well, my next guest may not support all of Krugman's analysis, but he also believes we're on the cusp of some terrible and frankly immoral decision-making. Yes, Will Hutton, the respected UK economist and commentator, believes morality is re-entering the picture and that many joining the debate are immoralists who neither know nor understand the monumental challenge of navigating their communities out of a major credit crunch aftermath. Will Hutton is full of indignation about what he sees as the failure of sensible policy making at last weekend's G20 meeting. And a short time ago, I spoke to him.
Good morning.
In many ways, Will Hutton, I thought the various moves suggested that there were some genuine changes underway that would prevent us going backwards. You see it differently, do you?
Yes. I mean, basically, there's too much debt in the world. There's too much private debt above all, and there's growing public debt. And it's a huge overhang from the decade, the 15 years, up to the credit crunch in 2007. And we know from the experience of countries like Japan and Sweden and even the United States, what happens are it's like a bear with a sore head, actually, an economy with too much private debt. And we've never had a circumstance in the world in which so many countries at the same time have stricken banking systems and this vast private debt overhang. And to say, as the G20 did, that actually the priority is, in the jargon, fiscal consolidation, i.e. public debt cutting, at a time when people are cutting their private debt, is to have the two great engines of a market economy, both the public sector and the private sector, belt tightening simultaneously. And there's no economic logic to that. The logic to it is about false morality, in my view, that somehow, you know, public is bad and public debt is bad and we must live within our means. We know that if the private sector belt tightens, if the public sector belt tightens at the same time, we know this in the 1930s, and we know that Paul Krugman said from the late 19th century, economies get into terrible trouble. And this could be, as he says, I don't quite go as far as him, but it's certainly a prolonged period of economic stagnation, yeah.
And debt has become such a dirty word. You're very interesting on this. You write of a Puritan self-restraint that is sweeping across your nation, the UK, and you believe that just below the surface, the prohibition against usury, against interest, that is a very old aspect of religiosity, actually, that this lies just below the surface. I find this very provocative.
Well, I mean, both Christianity and Islam take the view that it is the weak that borrow money, that the money lender charging a rate of interest is preying on the weak. They, you know, both are against the principle of the rate of interest. I mean, both religions have this view. In the Old Testament, there was the Jubilee year every 49 years where, you know, the debts were wiped clean and you relieved poor people of their debts. Now, there's a very deep thing in Western civilization, this kind of anti-debt view, and it's applied after 20 years, kind of rollicking around in the kind of economic whorehouse of borrowing money. There is this kind of moralism. And, of course, it's doubly true of the some economists, not all, who take the view that anything the state does, anything the public sector does, is inefficient. if the state borrows, well, it's being immoral. And I think there is that, I mean, that's definitely there with Angela Merkel and the way that she approaches her lectures about debt. The Germans have introduced a law which will require the Federal Republic of Germany in 2016 to always balance its budget. The British government has said in the budget just last week the target will be always to have the so-called structural deficit at zero. So you've got countries adopting a policy in which there's economics to that. That's a moral position.
But Will, can I just cut through? Do you mind just ask, because you say that there are comparisons, recent comparisons that can be made, for instance, with the way Sweden took on its public debt in the 90s over a period of time, which you say was much more healthy and rational.
Yeah, you can see this. You know, Sweden, talking about Britain, we have a very large deficit. It is larger, fractionally larger, than in the crisis in 1976 when we went to the IMF, and larger than we were in after the ERM crisis in 1992. And in both those cases, Britain took 10 years, not 5 years, to get out of its problems. It used tax and spending cuts half and half. What it didn't do was what the government's doing now, which is to reduce its deficit in 5 years rather than 10, and for four-fifths of the burden taken by spending cuts, which means some departmental programs will be close to eliminated. I mean, we may, if you take the government seriously, you know, you could lose part of our court system. We could close many of our primary schools. We could lose half of the British Army. I mean, this is an astonishing approach to this. Countries, Sweden was in a similar situation in 1993, and it's taken as long as 15 years, actually, to cut departmental spending by the amounts that the British government is talking about. You know, you can take your time over this. You don't have to do it in a kind of madcap kind of crisis mode. And by doing it in a madcap crisis mode, the risk is it's self-defeating.
Well, you suggest that there's actually a re-emergence of what you term market prejudice governing a lot of the decision-making at the moment. Tell us what you mean.
Well, I think that the view is that essentially there's two views of the world, really, I think. I mean, one is that, and I sometimes call them Protestant and Catholic, and just to kind of get it away from them, goes then back into this world of morality, because I do think there's a lot of moral judgments underneath economics which aren't actually flushed out into the open enough. I mean, there's one view which is that essentially anything the public sector does is a burden on the private sector, and that you want to keep the state as small as possible. And there's another view amongst economists that essentially public and private are codependent. And if the private sector kind of runs up savings and the public sector has because it's really interdependent between public and private, necessarily will have to spend to compensate. It's like a swing door. You know, the public and the private sector are so interconnected. And at the moment, that second view is just being swept to one side. I mean, people don't want to talk in terms of codependency between the public and the private. They want to talk about the necessity of just keeping the state and its debts at bay, and markets will do the work for us. But we know from the financial crisis that that's not a sensible view.
There is the logic, of course, that the Germans, with, and heavens, given their history, why wouldn't they at least say this, think about it, that if there is another crisis with the banks and they have to bail out the banks again, that in fact they have to get government finances in a bit more order in order to make sure that they're not going to have a banking crisis, which would bring the whole thing down. So they do have a logic for this, and they would say inflation loose, your whole society starts to invite all sorts of toxic elements in.
Well, none of the choices confronting the world are very happy. And I said in my article that actually, you know, one of the reasons why, certainly in Britain, there's a lot of anxiety about allowing public debt to carry on rising, is that we have seen in Europe investors unwilling to buy, you know, Greek debt, Spanish debt. And the absolute horror story would be if a country like Britain, with a very big banking system, had to put its public balance sheet, or Germany, had to put its public balance sheet behind the banks again. Mm. and had to sell debt to do so, and international investors wouldn't buy the debt, you know, that is Armageddon. I mean, that is hyperinflation territory, because all you can then do is print money. Our banking systems are still fantastically fragile in the West. I mean, the British banking system is very fragile, and the European banking system has not recognized lots of losses that are there under the surface. The American banking system, similarly, it could easily be that countries have to support their banking systems again, and with very much higher public debt levels. And that is really dangerous. So there's an element in which, you know, I mean, certainly that's part of the thinking of the of my own government. I know that the, you know, the Bank of England is very concerned that may happen, is very concerned to get public debt in a downward trajectory. But then you get yourself into a situation where, as now, I mean, the stock markets are very concerned worldwide about lack of growth. Why the lack of growth? Because everyone's cutting their public borrowing. You know, we're in a really, you know, every which way you turn, it's bad. The choices are invidious.
Well, what final question, Will Hutton? What's the least worst option then? What would you like to see happen?
Well, I agree with an internal IMF working paper that was produced in February, and then the IMF got frightened about it. I think that central banks worldwide should increase the target rate of inflation from 0 to 2% to 4%, and that central banks for a period of between 4 years and 6 years, time limited, should say they want inflation to be 4%, because I think in the end, managed but low inflation is the only way we can have a jubilee, if you like, of wiping the slate clean, of getting rid of the real value of this debt down. I think that is the least bad way through. And I think we have to, and I'd accompany it with the most aggressive action on our banking system. I think the bonuses that are being paid and dividends that are being paid out by our banks, and when they should be rebuilding their capital, is just trying to behave as business as usual. And these banks need with enormous urgency to get back into the comfort zone of having stronger balance sheets than they have and not having to rely on potential public support. Those are the two things that we must have. And I would, thirdly, I would try to stop this debt moralism, and I would require countries to take their time overcoming their public debt while the private sector sorts itself out. But I'm a tiny voice, and so is Paul Krugman, and we are not being listened to.
Will Hutton, I hope to speak to you in nicer times in months to come. Thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Will Hutton, economic columnist and vice chair of the Work Foundation, and apologies for that poor quality phone line. The Work Foundation has recently put out an assessment of the British budget, and you can go to their website to find it. And I think that internal IMF report he was talking about is from their think tank called Centre Forum, dealing with debt. So we'll have details of that on our website, and we'd appreciate, if you've read something interesting, please let us know too. Now, we had an extraordinary response. I honestly think that's not over the top, to Betty Bursky's letter last week, if you recall, who really lamented just where were we in Australian politics. And she was an 85-year-old lady, and she wrote an extremely eloquent letter, which a lot of people have come to us and asked for the letter. And anyway, Betty has obviously had quite a few people come to her, and she's just written a little reprise, which I'll read now, and I'll do some more letters, because we've had a range of correspondence. I'll read more in the second half of our program. Betty Bursky says, I was surprised last Saturday to hear out of the blue my thoughts on Kevin Rudd being read over Saturday Extra. Since then, I am one of many millions, I suspect, who've been on an emotional roller coaster ride, especially Labour voters. That distressed but so gracious speech of Mr. Rudd, his commitment to the people of Griffith and through them, I feel, to all Australians. What sometimes comes across as lip-smacking self-congratulation by Julia Gillard. Kevin Rudd's courage in sitting that final day on the back bench. His grace and loyalty to the party that had treated him so badly. But through it all, I began to think, if Kevin Rudd can stay loyal to his basic principles, if his love of his country and its people can transcend his own hurt and humiliation, then surely I can do nothing but follow his example. How else can I vote but Labour? And so I will. But Julia Gillard and her government should be aware. Many, many Australians have been deeply hurt and angered by all this, not only Labour voters, I suspect. And we are sick of spin and glib phrases from both sides. We are not all stupid, out here in voterland. Now, we've got some different responses from quite a few of you, and I'll read a range of those out in our second hour. It certainly has been an incredible time, and I actually think worthy of a great deal more discussion. But we'll be back after eight. We're going to talk about the war against baby girls and also conspiracy theories in the Middle East. It's 8 o'clock.